Darren, that's really interesting talk. And I think from what you said previously, you're not a public speaker. I think you've just booked your ticket to be the first speaker on the series that he's suggesting. I mean, I think that's absolutely brilliant what you've just been talking about, and really interesting. And on the issue of the Bolsheviks, I'm beginning to use this. I'm beginning to use the archive as well now, and getting information from other members about where things might be, that might be useful for current issues. So the work that you've done, I think that we ought to have a big vote. So thanks for the efforts that you're making, mate. It's really, really useful. But seriously, I think you should put yourself down for a talk about the party's attitude towards Bolshevism.
Bear in mind, I'm like I say, I'm not being, it's not false modesty. I'm just not. I'm more happy conversing about these subjects and like this roundtable discussions. I'm just a speaker. Reminds me too much of school. But thanks for your kind words.
Could I ask a question, please? The first thing you were saying was that the early standards were difficult to digitize. Could you explain why?
I can only explain in terms of how I've tried to do it. One is actually the size of the standards. Or A3 size, you know, the like the old sort of old-fashioned broadsheet newspapers in size. I don't pretend to know the tech behind this, but there's a possibility that it might be the fonts that were used for the early standards. It might just be like fonts were just very difficult to scan in. There's also the fact that I've been using what Tristan and Norbert tried to use, which was a microfiche of the standards, which were, I believe, at the London School of Economics. I don't know when they were placed there. I don't know who placed them. And unfortunately, it is the case that some of the early standards were scanned in, were just, I don't know, there's just, well, I used to work as a printer a very long time ago, and people who in printing will know the term scumming. Like the inks is like there's a sheen of ink over text, and there was a lot of standards, unfortunately, especially from like the 1918 to 1921 periods, which is actually one of the most interesting periods in the history of the standards, which were literally you can just scan them in, you just couldn't read them. And it kind of was kind of curious that this was a microfiche of pile in an academic library, and I'm like thinking, Christ, you know, there was academics who might have like this microfiche out to like study the party's history, and then there's like 3 years of standards history, and there's like 3 years where you just simply couldn't read it. So
Yeah.
can you get a sense of the party's history, especially that period, because it's a really interesting period. There was a happy ending to that, in a sense, and that since the lockdown, Adam Buick has done a hell of a lot of work working from bound volumes of like scanning material in. Now, Adam's really, he's hit the ball out of the park. He scanned in like 1980, definitely 1919, 1920, 1921, 22. After 22, my copies are more legible, so I can scan them in. So those years are now, I believe, on the party website. If they're not on the party website, they will be very soon. And they're on my blog. And I really recommend people reading. Anybody who thinks the standard's kind of stale, says the same things, or there's a house style, I really recommend reading like 1919 standards, 1920 standards. There's a lot of writers writing during that period who just wrote in that period. Don't really know who they are, unfortunately, because sometimes they would use pseudonyms, pen names, or just initials. And I've tried sometimes to track down names. Sometimes I have. Most times I haven't. The palpable anger in the pages of the standard from that period, because we'll remember 1918, there was a khaki election. Boy George won a landslide. It was going to be a land fit for heroes. And then within months, you had mass unemployment and mass hunger. And just the sheer anger of what's happening to the working class is there in the pages. And there's some really good writers. Really, Stanley Steele rings to mind. There's others that I could think of. I might try and sort of post some links. You know, anybody that says the standard is kind of too sedate, you know, read that period. It's brilliant, you know.
Yeah, you know, mate, you're really enthusing me. I mean, I'd like to reiterate what's got. I'd be happy to hear you talk on that. I'll give way to Paul in a minute. I noticed that Paul has a question, but I kind of taking it back to what I was asking, although what you're saying is more interesting. There's a couple of aspects in terms of digitizing. Now, as you said, it was on microfiche. There's kind of two aspects. One is making it there for people to read, but another aspect is to read it in digitized so that, for example, you can do a search on, search on Stalin, for example, in which case you need to. So you could have like a perfectly reproduced copy, or you could have a terribly reproduced, you know, just actually the content without the text. And I think both are important, but certainly from my point of view, like if I wanted to research something, even if we just had the you know, like the text without any of the sort of like pictures so that you could do a search on it. So can you sort of like be a little bit more kindergarten here when you're talking about digitizing? Are you talking about sort of like being able to search text? Or is it primarily, you know, just actually having the hard copy on record? Do you get the distinction?
No, I get what you're saying. I mean, this is just a personal preference. I'm sure some people would disagree. I mean, there was a member. I don't know if he's still a member, but he's a big fan of just putting PDFs on websites. You know, like on. Libcom, the Libertarian Communist site, or on archive.org. And to me, if nothing else, then fair enough. My problem with that is that only really appeals to like academics or to like left transporters. I'm talking about this material trying to reach a wider audience. So that's when I've digitized it, it involves scanning in individual articles.
Right.
So, and then on web, I know they did this on the website, on the party website initially. Unfortunately, because of the hack, it's fallen to the wayside, but maybe it can be done in the future. On my blog, where I've scanned stuff in, I will label every article I've scanned in. Well, like you say, for example, Stalin, or if you're interested in a particular writer. For the longest time, one of my bugbears with this party website, apologies to certain people listening, is that they would leave the names of the authors off the articles when they're placed on the website. And my view is that if you like a particular article that happens to be written by a particular writer, then you want to read what that other writer has written. So, you know, I've made a point of like on the blog of like labeling articles to the best of my ability. So if, for example, you were interested in like the Labour government 1964 and 1970, we'll go on my blog, and the right hand side you can scan down. There's so many labels, it's ridiculous. Scan down and you'll see this particular section for 64-70. Because they've been scanned in individually, you can also see the inbox, so like keywords. But as I say, the party website was doing that as well. When Matt was transferring material from my blog over to the website, he was taking my labels and like applying them to the party website. Unfortunately, like I say, the party website was hacked for a couple of months. It had to be basically rebuilt, and that kind of got lost, the rebuilding. But if at some time in the future members want to do that again, they could even take the party's indexes. The standards always had indexes. Members every couple of years have compiled indexes of socialist standards for bound volumes. Could just dig those out of the party archive, and you know, it'll take a while, but you know, it's worthwhile. You could basically apply those labels to the individual articles, you know.
I think that's great. I am hogging it again, but so, I mean, that's an important job, and if that could be coordinated so that we know what's been done already, say which indexes, and then we can, so it can be divvied up amongst other people. I'd volunteer for that.
Yeah, I mean, I believe there's indexes for every standards. Like and they're done every 3 years. There's obviously people in this meeting who are better placed to answer this. And if they don't want to use my labels, because mine can be a bit obscure, can use them. They basically go through party archive, you know, the standard archive on the party website, and they just apply those labels to each article. It's probably not as time consuming as some people might fear.
No, just digitizing the indexes would be great. I mean, because even, you know, you see the article, and even if it's not digitized, you could go at head office or anyone could, in effect, you know.
That's an excellent idea. That's an excellent idea. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you could do a search, and if nothing else, you know where the article is, and you could maybe some of it's has been reproduced as a PDF, maybe not, but it sort of points you in the direction. Anyway, just say thanks, Darren. This has been really interesting. I'll leave other people to ask questions. Cheers.
So there's a question from Paul Edwards and a question from Howard Moss. So Paul, if you all right, if not Paul, then Howard.
Okay. I'll come on if you like. Inspiring talk, Darren. Long time as well. Long time since senior. Inspiring talk. A criticism, this, but as you were talking about the Marxist Internet Archive, I brought it up on the screen, and there's a massive list of periodicals issued there from all sorts of different periods. I don't see the standard on that. I see names of certain party writers among the names. I actually see the standard listed among the journals, among the periodicals there.
Howard, it's not there. That's basically why I was making, you know, we haven't done that yet. Basically, only people who, basically the Marxist Internet Archive works a volunteer system, and basically the people who volunteer for a particular group or organization is the reason that it's basically you support those politics. So people who have been involved in working from our tradition, who have been involved in working the Marxist Internet Archive, have been Adam Buick, Michael Schwarty, American member in Japan, Daryl Whitehead, and me a little bit. And that's what I was suggesting at the end, is that you should maybe individual members who sort of the tech maybe think about volunteering to put the standard on there. And I personal opinion, I think it'd be best to start with the early standards. You know, just basically use it as an opportunity to start from 1904, you know, fill the gaps, you know, and it's another place where our material will be. You know, it's this website is accessed by millions of people. What happens is that when new material is added to this website, like notifications, you know, like every couple of weeks or every month, if you sign up, you'll get a newsletter, the MIA, and say, well, this speaker or this writer or this journal has been added. Again, that's reaching an audience which we otherwise possibly wouldn't reach. That's why I'm suggesting maybe put ourselves to trying to put the standard on, start at the beginning. And as I said previously, we've digitized so much of the standard now that you'd be surprised how quickly it would fill up. It's not going to fill up overnight by any means. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if all of the standards, 116 years, will be on the net in a couple of years, you know. Even if we're just going at the same pace we're going right now. Because we really have kind of broken the back of putting the standard on the internet, and it definitely should be on this website.
May I ask one question, please? I mean, honestly, probably by far and away one of the most interesting and encouraging talks we've had so far. Thank you so much for that, Darren. I think, you know, it's admirable absolutely admirable, and huge respect to you for taking the time and the effort to do what you're doing. It's absolutely terrific. I spent over 30 years in the printing industry myself as a screen process printer, and I certainly understand the term scumming. It crosses a lot of printing processes, and I recognise that. As far as the actual physical, my main question is, I'm really interested to know, what is physically and technically involved in actually transferring from hard copies over to and up, say, into the cloud or whatever you want to call it? And secondly, just one additional question, do we have similar copies? I'm thinking about a risk assessment here. Are you, and it's probably a silly question because I'm pretty sure you've got it covered, but are you taking copies and transferring them to disk form? So once again, you know, how do you actually get them from paper to internet, and do we have copies on disks? Cheers.
Okay, Paul. In answer to that, I believe we do have them on disks, because that's basically how I got them originally. As I said at the beginning of the talk, Tristan Miller and Norbert Sandin, this was originally their baby. You know, they were going to digitize, and they honestly were very committed to it. And they were working on a microfiche. They got a copy of the standard from 1904 to 1972, the London School of Economics Library. And then they sort of spent a few days like working flat out, scanning in 072 pre-1998 standards. And they had them on disks. So we have them as PDFs. As I explained before, you know, some of the early copies from microfiche are readable. So at some point, there's going to be some issues. Well, it is going to be a case of like getting either bound volumes or, you know, single copies from head office archive scanning. So, right, with regards, you know, stuff that I've done, I probably haven't backed up as much. You know, the stuff that I've actually digitized, I haven't backed up because it's now on the standard, on the party website. As I say, I think before, there is a concern that, you know, websites crash or get deleted. So we should be trying to sort of, I believe you can archive websites digitally. You know, so if the worst case scenario happens, they're retrievable. That's what happened with the party website. I hope it doesn't happen because it's a lot of work to reconstruct. I'm sorry if I hope that answers your question. Apologies if I've missed anything.
It does, Dan. It does. It really does. And I thank you kindly once again for answering the question and the sheer incredible effort that you're putting in.
It'd be remiss of me if I didn't mention other people involved in this. You know, Tristan, Norbert. People like Graham Taylor in Denmark did a lot of work. Rob Stafford, you know, some people will know these people. Adam Buick, Matt Colbert. You know, it's not just myself. You know, I just happened to be where I just was at a loose end because of the family commitment. So I've basically just taken this on board. But lots of other members who've done their bit. And obviously the comrades actually write the articles for the Standard, because I've never written an article in my life and probably never will. It's definitely a team effort.
Team effort, indeed. Good, cool. Yeah, excellent. Thanks, Darren.
Okay, there's a question from Tim.
Yeah, hi, Darren. Yeah, I just like to echo, you know, all the praise that's come before, really. I mean, it's such an impressive piece of work. And as you say, it's not just you. You acknowledge a number of other people, as you have just then. So it's, you know, it seems to me that, you know, the two things about this, really. One is, you know, trying to get people to do the work on loading the material. And, you know, obviously that's the starting block, really. But your talk, you know, was sprinkled with, you know, many different reasons for doing it, you know, the purpose of it. And You know, it strikes me as I think about it, and you know, you talk about some of those different aspects, that it is, you know, such an important project. And I know we're lacking numbers, we're lacking people on the ground and so on, But the second aspect, you know, is such an important thing to take forward in various ways, and all the, you know, maybe 15, 20 ideas of justifying why this is important. We could take some of those forward potentially in a practical way. You know, I mean, just off the cuff, you know, our prospective new members are very often, well, the main source really is flyers, you know, inserts rather in various publications, and then sending out three standards. I don't know how they're selected, but I'm assuming that they're selected from, you know, recent ones, really. I'm not sure whether the last three. But and that may encourage them or discourage them, depending on who's been writing on those particular standards at the time. It seems to me, you know, we could add to that, you know, some URLs to some of the material you've already loaded, you know, some of the key stuff that you talk about from particular dates and so on. That is very impressive. I remember when I came in 3 years ago reading, you know, the Socialism or Your Money Back publication, and some of those old articles are, you know, really, really very impressive. And so it seems to me we could, you know, for example, combine the three standards with some URLs of archive material that people could access. But you could go on and on and on. You know, I mean, we're not much going on at the moment, but we're looking at induction. We don't get many new members at the moment. We're looking at induction pack, and the same applies there, and so on and so on. Talks, as Steve was mentioning, you were mentioning. You know, so it, you know, I mean, if we could get, you know, a few people that could take that second aspect forward as well as loading the material, it seems that would be very important.
And I agree, Tom. I mean, what you said kind of reminded me of something, excellent thing that the party did back in the 80s, and I believe it's available on the party website. It sounds dated, but it's not. They did a series of articles called. Articles for new members, I believe. Sorry if I got the title wrong. I think it was a selection of like 40 or 50 theoretical articles, which were put together by comrades in the old Enfield and Haringey branch, I believe. And I think they're still collected as a collection of articles on the website. And it's a fascinating resource because it does basically predates what I've been saying, you know, this idea of trying to sort of anticipate like the second question that people might have about aspects of the party's politics, you know, so, you know, might, you know, Russian Revolution is an obvious one. Also things like, you know, socialism and the environment, issues on reformism, you know, just things like that, you know, so maybe a new version of that, or maybe just a resuscitation of that, because it's still an excellent resource. It's just, you know, maybe just briefly get back to this idea of just using our party history, like on social media. And I can give you like a very recent example, business of the statues in Britain and the kind of moral panic which has arisen over the possibility of Baden Powell statue being taken down or defaced in Bournemouth, maybe, or Dorset. And a lot of people have, like, you know, I'm sure people have followed the story. You know, he expressed admiration for Hitler and the Nazi Germany and Mein Kampf in his private diaries in the 30s. You know, I'm not going to discuss the rights and wrongs of tearing down his statue. A lot of people have turned around in social media and saying, well, yeah, this is ahistorical. You know, people are in and about what Baden Powell said, but that was the time, that was the view. Well, article from 1914 written by Gilbert McClatchy in the Standards on the politics of the Boy Scouts movement. And I put it on social media, you know, put it on Twitter, put it on Facebook, you know, and it's an excellent example of where you can actually like argue against this accusation that people are kind of like year zero people, that there was never any criticism at the time of someone like Baden Powell and, you know, the, is, you know, just the just the, you know, the homegrown fascism, if you like, of his politics. You know, it was there. You know, it was kind of there from the get-go. And it's just a lot easier to point, sometimes it's a lot easier to point to an article from 1914 than to try and argue the case in 2020. You know, I do it all the time with the Russian Revolution. You know, why should I argue with a Stalinist or Trotskyist about the pros and cons of the Bolsheviks in 1917 when I can say, well, there you go, that's what we were arguing back in 1918. You know, get back to me. Do you have any questions about that? You know, it's just, you know, there's other examples I could give of where having a digitized archive, it's basically been able to kind of provide like political ammunition to answer some certain objections to, you know, our politics, you know, in the here and now. So, you know, that's just one example that I could give.
Anyone else? I can see Vinny's typing. Right, so Vinny's just saying, that's really interesting, as a number of prominent lefties, i.e. the Webbs, were promoting eugenics, perhaps in a similar way to Baden-Powell. So read that Brown C. Shtick. Tim's got another question.
Tim? Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on that, really. I mean, that's such a great example of putting forward what must be the most you know, the most powerful aspect of the party, which is its insight into the contemporary politics and obviously the history, now going back over 100 years, and its consistency, because and, you know, the depth of analysis, the intellectual argument and so on, which when you compare with contemporary politics outside of the party, other things that are most lacking are completely absent. There's no depth, there's no intellectual rigor, and there's no consistency. And so that's such a great example, you know, in a small way of how and an easy way, a shorthand, you know, as Darren says, you don't have to write an article about Baden-Powell, but to be able to reference back, you know, and that's such an impressive thing. Yeah, okay, that's what I want to say.
Okay, Dougie.
Yeah, just talking about statues and things, you know, that Churchill was a racist. I mean, there's a lot of worse things that Churchill did. He was into eugenics, he was a racist, and he was responsible for the death of millions of people. And then the boxing off his statue to protect the statue. So, I think the Standard, you know, would probably have articles about Churchill that could expose him, right? You know, so it'd be good to have them on online or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, I also think it's kind of, this is where I think world literature has an audience beyond, wider than we realise. You know, if nothing else, it provides a kind of corrective to certain myths which have been built up over time, you know.
Well,
the Churchill myth is crazy. You know, the working class hated Churchill. You know, it wasn't just about 45. Obviously, like the Labour government kicking Churchill out, you know, the war leader. You know, it was about Churchill as one of the leading members of the Tory government in 26. It was about Churchill during the First World War. You know, there's a wee snippet, a Standard, I can't remember it offhand. Like a two-liner. It's basically they had space to fill in this Standard. I want to say it's from like 1920. If it's not from 1920, it's from 1913. The backstory basically is that his plane crashed. And what happened was, is that a week before, the same plane, Churchill in it, he was traveling somewhere. Basically, this Standard snippet basically said, basically along the lines, to paraphrase, I wish, it's a bit of a shame that the plane didn't crash a week earlier. And it's kind of cruel, but it kind of shows you the kind of disdain people had for Churchill. The kind of, sadly, the mythology the working class has kind of embraced about Churchill in like the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. I don't remember as a kid growing up. I don't remember it in this reverential, you know, And again, I think the standard is very good to just find, if nothing else, providing a different perspective on certain issues. You know, read up on the standards from '40s, from the post '45 period. I mean, standard got a lot of things wrong. Standard got certain things wrong. The party got certain things wrong. They expected certain things to happen, but they didn't. '45 is a good example. They generally thought that '45 would be a repetition of 1918. They were expecting slump, you know, comparable to 1918, 1919, I spoke of earlier. It didn't happen. I think that partially explains, you know, the temper of the party, if you like, in the '40s and '50s, if you read the standards. You know, it really did kind of, in my personal opinion, you read the standard from that period, even though the party had like a large membership, its largest membership, there wasn't the same, to my mind, the same energy or anger existed in other periods of the party's history when it was much smaller. So that's a different issue, maybe a different discussion. Sorry, to get back to, if you read standard from 45 to 51, obviously you had the Labour government, but this left-wing Labour government, which has been mythologized. It's like Churchill has been mythologized. And, you know, some members will already know this. You know, the troops were sent in to break strikes. Britain sent British foreign policy was on parcel of the Cold War, you know, the development of the H-bomb. Still had an imperial mindset, apart from India. India was granted independence. Basically, the Labour government was no different from previous governments in its attitude towards the empire. Lots of examples where this so-called beacon of hope of 45 to 51, lots of examples, you know, austerity that was in place, which is more than capitalist class. If people were able to read that, well, there's wee snippets about Nauran Bevan, who's another patron saint of British politics. And, you know, it's a good corrective for all this mythology that we face every day now on social media.
Okay, Mike Foster's got a question.
You're right there. Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, I found that really interesting. And I'd like to echo what others have said. Thank you and the others for, you know, all the hard work. Yeah, it's much appreciated. Often sort of dip into the blog and, you know, have a quick read as what the latest post is. One thing that popped into mind when I've looked at sort of back issues of the Standard, I think it was from the sort of the mid-70s. There was a series of cartoons which I thought were very well put together, very well drawn, and it was, I don't know if anyone else knows of them. I think it was sort of characters that represented the Labour and the Liberal Party at the time, and they had names like Libby Rolls, I think, was one of the characters, and Lee Burr Party, with, you know, the sort of play on the name. And of course, you know, more recently we've had you know, Peter Riggs' excellent free lunch cartoons. So I was just wondering if, you know, when you've come across, especially older issues of the Standard, if cartoons were sort of really a thing. I know they've sort of dipped in and dipped out of the Standard. And of course, it's another way of putting the message across in a, you know, sort of a brief way with a memorable picture and a bit of wit. So, yeah, I was just wondering if you had any sort of views on sort of cartoons that have appeared every now and again in the publication. Cheers, thanks.
Mike, yeah, this is when I sort of reveal my inner anorak. I believe the first cartoon appeared in the Standard in 1927, I believe. Really, unfortunately, you know, I love political cartoons as well. I could off on them at the time. Unfortunately, there really wasn't a lot of cartoons in the Standard in the early, especially the early days, and you read other left press from that period, and the journals did have cartoons. It was part of their identity, the look of the journal, etc., you know, which is a shame. But yeah, there was one in 27, which was an interesting one. It was basically about, I guess, like, Ed, if I remember it, it was a full page, and it was like basically about economic conscription. It was basically about, you know, there was a headline and something along the lines of basically midst of economic downturn, people were joining the army like they always join the army because they had no alternative. I believe there was another cartoon maybe a couple of years later think it was the same person. I believe it was name that's in my head is Cameron. There's a possibility, I'm not 100% sure, but it may be a guy called William Cameron, who was a party member who wrote a novel, which actually novelized part of the party history in the 40s. Maybe the same guy, I'm not 100% sure, called The Day Is Coming. I've got a copy of the book on my shelf, but I've never read it. I actually got a poor review in the Standard, got a sniffy review in the Standard from Gilmack. I didn't like it because thought the socialist characters in the novel dropped their H's too much. So back to the cartoons, that particular cartoon strip you're talking about was actually by Baltrop, Robert Baltrop. He was one of the editors of the Standard in the 70s. He also contributed cartoons to the Standard in the 1950s. And when I digitize articles from that period, I do try and include the cartoons. The cartoonists in the Standard, I believe Alwyn Edgar, believe it or not, still writing for the Standard today. He's been writing since from 1950. He would contribute the odd cartoon. There was a Scottish member of Glasgow, Edinburgh branch, sorry, called Jack Gold, who contributed cartoons in the early 70s. There's a couple of front covers, I believe, that were done by Jack Gold. Baltrop, as I say, that comic strip, an excellent illustrator that members will know of because he designed a lot of the front covers for the Standard in the 80s, called George Medeman, who was a party member from the 40s. But he was just one of these members on the books, really. And in the early 80s, I believe, the Standard put out a request for illustrators. This guy who'd been a member for like 30 years, and he was a fine artist and fine cartoonist, and he contributed a lot of excellent cartoons to the Standard and for party pamphlets through the 80s, 90s, basically up until he died, I believe, in the 2000s. Yeah, his name in the Standard was Greg, as you mentioned. There was the full-page cartoon that appeared in the Standard in 2007, 2008. I believe it was called The Ire of the Irate Itinerant. I don't actually know who the author or the cartoonist was. And there was another cartoon talking about people who you want to know more about. There was a brilliant cartoonist in the Standard in the mid-80s. And again, I might try and just find some of the pics and just post a link later on. I don't know who the person was. Unfortunately, they didn't have a signature on their cartoons. It wasn't Medeman. But just really good cartoonists run about sort of 84, 85, 85, 86. I wish there was, you know, I'm a great fan of cartoons. You know, I love there to be party cartoons, party memeists, etc. You know, so if you're out there, please come forward, you know.
Yeah, cheers. Fascinating. Thanks. Yeah, cheers.
All right. Dougie again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things people use for information is Wikipedia or whatever. And there's an instance when Paddy changed information about Keir Hardie, who died in 1915. But just before it, he was encouraging people to go and fight in the First World War, even though at the start of the war, he was against the war. He changed his tune, and quite a few people from the ILP supported people going off to fight each other, a bit like the SDP in Germany taking a nationalist side. I mean, a bit interesting to know about that. When Paddy changed the thing on Wikipedia, somebody got rid of it, you know. But I think if you can be consistent, you can keep putting things on Wikipedia and they'll get fed up trying to take them off, really. But I think sometimes we could put stuff on Wikipedia that would be more accessible sometimes.
I mean, I agree. You know, it's just making the making on party material available. Then, as long as it's out there, you know, any member can take any article from my blog or my website, and it's yours. You know, do what you will. You know, and that's a good case in point. You know, that was one of those articles. The one that Paddy's referring to, that was an article by Melvin Harris. I think was published in the Socialist Standard, and I believe it was 1959. Melvin Harris was from South Wales originally, and he was quoting from the local press about Hardy, because Hardy was an MP for Wales at that time. And, you know, if I hadn't read that article, I would still believe to this day that Hardy had taken a pacifist position in the First World War. So it's not that position, you know, and not just another example where you can point to like historical material, kind of just sow a seed of doubt in people's heads. So that's sometimes that's all we can do.
All right, just an indulgence.
Sure. Can I ask a question, or rather, can I point out that Darren was talking about people doing memes. We have got some memes on the text channel called Useful Links by Comrade Mullen from the States. They've just gone on recently. They're worth a look at.
All right, yeah. I see. So Dan Mullen's memes on the Useful Links text channel.
Yeah, sorry, I'm antediluvian. What is a meme?
It's stuff that goes onto social media, and there's one above in the speaking queue. If you look at the boots, that's an example of a meme. Up above in the speaking queue, just scroll up a very small amount.
It's a picture or an idea that expresses a concept or an argument very succinctly, and usually with humour.
Always with humour.
Succinctly expressed, Paddy.
Yes, thanks, Paddy. Cheers. Thanks, Liv.
So you can see it's not our normal forte.
All right, I'll ask it a sort of indulgent, pretty trivial question then, not untypically. I'll also have Darren, if you had to pick one standard contributor to represent the party case in written form, who would it be and why?
Oh, it's really hard, to be honest. There's different writers I like for different reasons. I'd have to give a couple of answers, actually. Maybe I didn't give enough time out to feel like discovered writers who previously just weren't sort of in party histories. There was a really good writer, the Standards, called John A. Dawson. I believe he was a member of the Burnley branch of the SPGB. And believe it or not, Burnley was a hotspot of what was one in the old days of social democracy. Marxian socialism. Well, Heinemann, who was the leader of the Social Democratic Federation, always wanted to get him into Parliament, and they never did, but always thought if they were going to get him somewhere, it'd be Burnley. Well, that was one of the few branches outside London in the early days, alongside Manchester and Nottingham. This guy, Dawson, who I don't know a lot about, but he was writing, he wasn't a founder member, he was writing about 1909 to about 1912, 13. He just wrote a series of really good articles. And when I think about it, it's not really much about expressing the party case, though he obviously did. It was just like taking events at that particular time. It was a tumultuous period, class war in Britain, immediate periods in 14. Arguably it's a period when syndicalism in Britain has its greatest support and audience, because generally people did think there was going to be like a upper general strike, Tom Mann, etc. Didn't pan out. He was living in Burnley, wrote a series of really interesting articles about cotton industry, you know, like not cotton industry itself, but just workers and cotton factories. He also wrote an interesting review of Kropotkin's History of the French Revolution. Back to your original question, if you're trying to say distill one writer who expresses bias, probably Adam Buick. That would be massaging his ego too much. But there was other writers. There was a guy from the 60s and 70s called David Steele, David Ramsey Steele, now lives in America. He's an anarcho-capitalist, wrote a book on that subject. He was an excellent writer in the Standard in the late 60s, early 70s. One of the founder members of the party, who I think is a really good writer, who unfortunately doesn't get enough credit, is Jacum, J-O-C-O-M-B. There was like a passion to his writing, which I don't think is always present in some writers. You know, like Jack Fitzgerald was a dry writer, but very dry. Funnily enough, it reminded me, if you read the early articles of Edgar Hardcastle, Hardy, who wrote under the pen name of H, son of a founder member of the party, and he was a member of the party, I believe, 1920 up until his expulsion from the party in the early 90s. Into that, you probably presume to know Hardy's style as a writer because he was an economist with a certain subject matter that he would write on, etc. If you read the early articles from Hardy as a young man, he's in his early 20s, and this was a guy who was a class-conscious objector during the First World War, so he actually went to prison, Dartmoor, and be conscripted in the First World War, which, you know, I wouldn't have the guts to do, but fair play to him. Read his early articles, and it's a different Hardy, different Edgar Hardcastle, you know. There's an energy, an urgency in his writings, which, you know, obviously wasn't there later on. That's not his fault, you know. I mean, I don't think you can sort of pretend to write like that. You obviously have to feel that way. If things don't pan out, you know, if the working class don't, you know, up socialist ideas to the extent that you hope, then write that same kind of urgent article that you did as a young. You know, he recommend reading his early stuff from the early 20s. I don't want to miss anybody out. I would go into different areas. You know, I think there's certain writers who wrote particular subjects which were really good. The Ball was a wonderful short story writer in the 90s and 2000s. I was one of those Socialist Party members who, when I first read our short stories in the Standard, I didn't get it. I'd just be like, what's this? Point of this? It was only after when I said there was one particular short story she wrote that I just thought was wonderful. And I went back and I realised, yeah, I'm an idiot. It's really hard to write like this, to communicate like this. She was wonderful at sort of communicating like socialistic ideas a different way for the norm, you know. I would give a shout out to the comrades in Glasgow branch who used to do Sting in the Tail in the 80s and 90s. You know, it was a column that would appear on the back page of the Socialist Standard. It was just little snippets. It was really funny, really to the point. We're doing something that I don't think everybody can do. We can all kind of knock out like a boilerplate where you should be a socialist article, you know, what that one article in is, to kind of write kind of pithy, short way and or short of perfect, as you can tell. It's very difficult, you know. So those comrades in Glasgow branch used to do that. Collective effort was wonderful. Some examples I could probably come up with, like any others, I guess.
All right. Cheers, Darren. Yeah.
Thanks. ask a one sentence question and I'll give you a 50 sentence answer.
Very interesting.
Can I just do some like trivial things, even more trivial things? Like
you can, but first, Howard has a question.
Oh, sure.
Sorry, I'll resist my own as an Ireland writer. To say that I'm thinking about writers in the Standard since the early 70s when I've been in the party, and I would agree with some of those mentioned by Darren, in particular Hardy, who carried on being a brilliant writer, Dave Steele in his while he was still in the party in the late 60s, early 70s. He was a journalist and he was a first-class writer as well. And a couple who haven't been mentioned, Ralph Critchfield, who, although in his 90s now, has been writing for the Standard. Until sort of pretty recently, a brilliant trenchant writer used to write the column called The Greasy Pole, among lots of other things as well, on Cook, who died a number of years ago, and whose writing was as much as anyone else has got me interested in the socialist case. There's John Crump as well, of course, in the 70s in particular, left the party but remained sympathetic, was an excellent writer. Of course, Adam, who's written, what, hundreds, perhaps thousands of articles for the Standard, and, you know, it's probably a bit embarrassing for me to say this, but always writes with tremendous lucidity, clarity, combined with found knowledge, tremendous record. Notice Steve Coleman was mentioned earlier, and was no longer in the party, but was an incredibly active member in the 70s, 80s in particular, and early 90s, and wrote loads and loads of articles for the Standard, and was probably the best party speaker at the time, but wasn't anything like as good a writer as a speaker. If you read his articles, they're a bit limp compared to his ability to actually capture, indeed, on occasions, mesmerize an audience. Anyway, there we are. I've had my say.
Darren, did you want to continue? Hey, just where, like, I was cut you off?
I saw how you're saying now. God said, yeah, I should mention also to Ralph Critchfield's brother, Eddie Critchfield, wrote in the Standard in the 60s. Another very fine writer. Lots of fine writers. You know, I feel a little bit guilty not mentioning more. You know, I think Paddy is a good writer, but don't tell him I said that. It's just little trivia things that I just kind of like, what if his backup, you know, just things like film reviews in the Social Standard. To the best of my knowledge, the first film review in the Social Standard is very, very brief, to the point of not being a film review, is 1927. Basically, a party member wrote about Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Sadly, I don't know the reasons for this, but the party not fill its pages of the Standard with a lot of one of the reviews, you know, like, which is a shame, because there was party members who could definitely write on that subject. But, film reviews in the Standard picked up in the 50s, just kind of curious, you know, just as an anorak about these things, just to see what kind of films they were reviewing. You know, it wasn't mainstream films, it was like the art house films, the new wave, it was Bergman, it was Fellini, and they did theatre reviews in the same period, and often than not, it was the same writers who did the theatre reviews and the film reviews. Michael Gill, Ian Jones, Ivimi Brothers, I don't know, is that right, in the 50s. Again, it was kind of the social realist kitchen sink dramas from the 50s, like Arnold Wesker and Brendan Behan, people like that, John Osborne. It's just interesting, you know, Michael Gill writing theatre reviews in the Standard in the 90s and 2000s. Really interesting, worth checking out. Just, you know, like, just curious to see, you know, for whatever reason, which is, again, I don't understand it, Standard never really reviewed music. You know, I've somebody who enjoys music, listening to music, likes political music. Whatever reason, there wasn't a lot of stuff written about music, the sort of socially or just reviews, you know. To the best of my knowledge, there's only been 4 album reviews in the Social Standard, 116 years, which I find kind of strange. Just things like that. Film reviews, again, just interesting. I touched upon it in the talk, but I didn't, you know, it's too big a subject, but it's just interesting different periods of the Standard, how different writers will imprint themselves, if you like, on the style or the tone of the Standard. And obviously, that's one example. All you need is a couple of Socialist Standard writers who want to write about theatre or write about music, and suddenly it's in the Standard.
You know? Vin has asked, which albums were they?
You asked, Vin? you put me on the spot. Tom Robinson's Power in the Dark, 1978. Dale Council's Our Favourite Shop. Came out in 85. I remember that because I bought it. It was reviewed in 86. And then if Perrin reviewed some I've never heard of. It was obviously his mate, old Stern John. And then there was this kind of leftist band from a couple of years ago, described themselves as guild socialists, which is kind of funny if you know about guild socialism, called the EHEE faction. And their album was reviewed by Errol, I don't remember his full name. I mean, I just point out another trivia thing. Why I find this kind of funny and fascinating. The early members of the SPGB, if there was an SPGB member who would have a biography or should have a biography, it's this guy called Moses Barrett. He wasn't a founder member. He joined the party in Manchester in 1906, 1907. This guy was a music critic for the Manchester Guardian. Some people claim he's actually the first ever disc jockey in history, because in the early 1920s, he actually was employed by the BBC. He was actually like making announcements in between records. Technically, he was a disc jockey. This was a guy who was like an expert. He was a clarinetist, I believe, and he was a music writer. He was also a revolutionary socialist. Some people will know about him from written about by Waltrop's book, The Monument. He's featured in some historical articles in the Standard. This was a guy who, when conscription was introduced in Britain during the First World War, like a few members, he wasn't going to go to prison, wasn't going to go to underground. So he went to the United States, like Ralph Cohen did the same. And search his name, Moses Barrett's, pops up all over the United States being arrested for speaking out against the war, against capitalism, for class war. He's 1 minute he's in New York speaking at Coney Island. There was a historical outdoor speaking. He's in Seattle. He was in Canada. This guy was in Detroit. This guy was everywhere. Eventually, he was arrested, I believe, during the Palmer Raids, which was a Red Scare. Basically, when America came into the war, they started cracking down on anarchists and socialists and whatnot. He was obviously a visible figure, so he was arrested and he was deported. And then for the next 2 or 3 years, he turns up in South Africa. They wouldn't let him get off the boat because his reputation had preceded him. He's known as so much of as an agitator, and he was in Australia. John Pilger, the writer John Pilger, mentions him in a book he wrote called Heroes. Turned up in New Zealand. This guy is fascinating. But to get back to the point, this guy was a musician. He worked for a record company. And he would do talks on music for some reason. Never in the Standards. I just presume the party just thought it was all about economics. So it wouldn't do reviews, wouldn't write about music, about film, write about theatre. Some novels which were reviewed early on, mention them if people ask, want to know what they are. Again, the party could be a bit dry, the Standard could be a bit dry at times, unfortunately. It's just a shame. Just some little snippets of party history, I guess.
Okay, so it's coming up to 9:05 now. If no one else has got anything else to ask, Darren, do you want to say anything more?
No. Just thanks for listening. I'm not a speaker, so thanks for listening to the end. I appreciate it.
No, it's great. I'd like to thank you for an excellent talk, Darren, and a really interesting discussion, and express gratitude to you and the comrades for the contribution to this vitally important project, the digitization project. But yeah, sure. Thanks very much, Darren. It's been a great talk. Very interesting evening.